Thanks for giving me the opportunity to come here and tell you about my work. Indeed, I'm going to talk about entanglement entropy and some of the subtleties that arise when the fields in question have gauge symmetry. So I'm just going to start with a summary. So in quantum field theory, regions of space are thought of as subsystems. And associated to each region, there is an entanglement entropy. So there's been a lot of interest in this quantity, especially in recent years. One of the original motivations for considering this quantity was to try to understand the origin of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, the fact that black holes have an entropy that grows with the area of the event horizon. More recently, in condensed matter theory, they've appeared as a probe of topological phases. So these are phases that resist a sort of usual treatment in terms of order parameters, but can be understood, can be sort of probed using the entanglement entropy. And also in string theory, as a sort of key part of the ADS-CFT dictionary that relates the entanglement entropy on the surface, in the boundary CFT to minimal surfaces in the bulk.
Does entanglement entropy depend on the state of the system as well as on the region?
Yes, it does. Right. I'll get into these definitions more precisely. Right now, I'm just summarizing, but indeed.
I understand.
So
I was trying to help.
I appreciate it. Thank you. So this has led to a number of very fruitful interactions between these fields. But when we have gauge fields, the sort of usual definitions that we use of entanglement entropy require modification. And I'll explain exactly how that happens. But in order to properly define the entanglement entropy associated to a region, we have to introduce extra states that live on the boundary of the region. And these are known in other contexts as edge states. And I'll explain specifically what those are. And I'll show that associated to these edge states, there's a sort of local contribution that depends only on data available at the boundary, and that this local contribution is not just sort of small. In many important cases, it's actually the whole thing or close to the whole entropy. Okay. Good. So that was the summary. So first, I'm going to talk about gauge theory, what the Hilbert space is, and how these edge states appear. To make these considerations precise and to talk about the entropy, I'm going to have to introduce a regulator. So I'm going to use one that preserves the gauge symmetry, namely a lattice. Then I'll consider three examples. So I'll do a two-dimensional Yang-Mills theory, the torque code, and I'll talk about lattice Yang-Mills at strong coupling and with conclusion. So this is the standard first slide of a talk on entanglement entropy. Let's consider a quantum field theory. In this case, I'll assume for definiteness that it's a scalar field. We can think of the states as functionals of the fields in like a Schrodinger representation. Then if we break space at one time into two regions, omega and omega bar being its complement, then we specify the field. We can specify the scalar field independently on those two regions. And the state, which is a functional of those two pieces of data, lives in a tensor product space. Okay. And now whenever you have a tensor product of this form, you can construct a reduced density matrix corresponding to one part of the system. So this rho sub omega is obtained by tracing out everything in the complementary Hilbert space. And that state, even if the original state psi was pure, rho sub omega is mixed and it has an entropy, this S, which is called the entanglement entropy. And it's sort of generally believed that for ground states of gap systems, we have an area law. So this entropy scales with the area of the boundary, but it diverges with the ultraviolet cutoff L. And that's just due to the fact that the entanglement entropy is sensitive to fluctuations that appear on all distance scales all the way up to the cutoff.
Okay. If you don't have a gap, you don't expect an area law?
So in one-dimensional, one plus one conformal field theories, for example, the area law would say that the entropy is just is bounded by a constant, but in fact it grows logarithmically.
What about higher dimensions? The area law came just from the very short wavelength.
I think in higher dimensions you'd again have an area law. I'm not aware of any counterexamples.
Apparently, the condensed matter people claim, although he says he isn't sure whether he understands this, but apparently they claim that if you have a system that's not the vacuum, but like a Fermi C with fermions, that you get like an A log.
It's not a claim, it's a proof.
A proof. Well, they prove that they probably claim it.
You can calculate analytically. One-page paper. Yeah. It's L log L. It's not some conductor. Whenever you have a
right.
You have to power D minus one log L.
Okay, but okay. Okay, so that's a particular case. But I mean, the Ruhtak-Yanagi formula would say that even
but you have cases where you just some conjecture where we don't know how to capture Fermi surface in the bulk. Ruhtak-Yanagi is just some.
Okay, one would say that if Ruhtak-Yanagi formula is correct.
Yeah.
Suppose, let me say, if
Ruhtak-Yanagi formula always gives you area law, suppose.
Yeah.
It doesn't violate area law, then you would say that it's impossible to capture using Ruhtak-Yanagi formula fermions, which are Fermi surfaces.
Okay.
Because it's a contradiction with what is known.
But you could have, massless bosons or something.
I think for ordinary critical systems, are there logs in the sub-leading term? I think there's a log in the L to the zero.
That's right. So this is like the leading behavior, and then you can have sub-leading logarithms in conformal.
So for Fermi surface, the leading term is not
linear.
Right. It's a gapless system with Fermi surface.
Very yes.
So this is the statement for gap.
That's right. This is not in. Yes.
I was asking if there are generalizations to not all. Gapless systems, but some gapless systems might still.
Right. So this is right. So it is believed for gap systems, and then for gapless systems, it's not clear that there's a general rule. Okay, good. So this is sort of the usual case. So now let's think about gauge theories. So in a gauge theory, your states are not just any old functional of the connection. They're gauge invariant functionals of the connection. So what does that mean? Well, sort of formally, you can think of them as living in this space of equivalence, defined on equivalence classes of vector potentials, mod gauge transformations. But another way of saying that is just that the states have to satisfy constraints. So the generator of these gauge transformations is a constraint. So in the usual Yang-Mills case, it's Gauss's law, okay, and that's a constraint at each point that your state has to satisfy. But it's now a differential equation in space, which means that it actually relates what's going on one. So you make this very sort of sharp cut between two regions, and now this constraint relates what's happening on one side of that boundary to what's happening on the other side, and you no longer have this tensor product structure. So we have to sort of go back a step and think about what we do in the case where we don't actually have this tensor product, which we use to define the reduced density matrix and the entanglement entropy. Okay. So the basic issue can be seen in yet another way, that if we want to look at gauge invariant states, the sort of standard gauge invariant operators to look at are Wilson loops, and those are not localized at a point. So for example, we could consider this electric string state sort of sitting in space and straddling this boundary, this dashed line, between the two regions we want to consider. So what do we expect? How do we expect that to break down in a sort of tensor product description of the Hilbert space? We'd expect it to look possibly like a sum of terms that look like electric strings anywhere sort of in the bulk, but on the boundary they have to end. And if we were to impose Gauss's law at the boundary, this would not be allowed. So what this suggests is that what we need to do is actually relax the gauge symmetry at the boundary and not impose Gauss's law there. Good. So we're going to relax gauge invariance at the boundary. But now, in so doing, we have, by reducing the amount of gauge symmetry we mod out by, we increase the number of states of our theory. So we get new degrees of freedom that live on the boundary. And these have been studied before. They're called edge states. And they appear, for example, in the quantum Hall effect, where they are physical electrons that live right on the boundary and are responsible for the Hall connectivity. But in this sort of churns, they appear even in this sort of low energy Chern-Simons description, where you don't have local degrees of freedom, because of the gauge symmetry, you still have these things on the boundary. And they've also appeared in certain proposals for 2+1 quantum gravity based on Chern-Simons theory, where you have this question of, for example, in 2+1 pure gravity, you have black holes. They have an entropy, and the question is, there's this question of where does their entropy come from? There are no local degrees of freedom that can be responsible for this, but it's been suggested that the fact that you have edge states, the edge states could be responsible for this entropy. So just to say that these things have been studied before.
Two,
yes?
Two quick comments. So I suppose those are the boundary gravitons that people talk about?
I think they've been called that, yeah. There are a bunch of different names. People have called them by different names.
And the other thing is, by relaxing the gauge invariance, that's the same thing as saying that you're defining the gauge group to the gauge transformations, which are the identity on the boundary.
That's right. So yeah, if you wanted to make this very precise in a continuum quantum field theory, you'd say that the constraints are not just operators at a point, but they have to be smeared by some test functions in order to turn them into, honest operators. And then you would say that those test functions have to vanish as you approach to the boundary. That's right. Yes, you're enlarging your Hilbert space, introducing these edge states. That's right. Good.
Isn't it easier to just go to a lattice formulation and make that a little bit more precise?
Well, you're two slides ahead of me, I think. Yes. good. So this is just leading up to that. So now, when we do that, we're not going to have an equality of the Hilbert space of all of space with the tensor product of two regions. And the reason is that if you take this tensor product, it includes things that look like this, where the electric charges don't, this sort of surface charges don't match up on either side. Okay. Now these aren't allowed in the bigger theory, which is why the Hilbert space is only a subset. But actually, this is a really good feature. What it means is that each of these sort of factor Hilbert spaces carry a representation of the local gauge group on the boundary. But the states in H are special. They're they're invariant under that action, and that's a huge symmetry group under which our density matrix is invariant, and that is. That's the thing that I'm going to exploit. So any questions at this point? I'm about to move on to the lattice. Great. Okay. So I'm going to introduce a lattice. So here it is. So in a lattice gauge theory, what we do is we assign elements of the gauge group to edges. I'm going to call those U's, and they're valued in the group. It's basically the holonomy of the connection along that edge. The gauge transformations act at the vertices, and they act on a holonomy in the usual way, with the inverse at the source, and then the group element at the target of the edge. These edges are directed.
Sorry, are you latticizing space and time, or just space?
Just space. Yeah, that's important.
Gauge space, time, gauge.
Yeah, that's right. So, right in this formulation, I'm going to impose Gauss's law at each of the vertices. So, I think that takes care of that. Good, and I'm going to introduce an orthonormal basis of the gauge invariant Hilbert space, which is labeled by so-called spin network states. So just to explain what these are, this is basically just going to the electric field basis. In fact, if this was a U1 gauge theory, it would be literally just a basis of quantized electric fields along the edges. But in a general group, what you have to do is assign irreducible representations of the group to each edge. So I'll describe how one of these spin network states acts in the connection basis. What you do is you take each of your U's that live on these edges, and you use a representation attached to each edge to turn it into a matrix. Okay. So now you have a huge collection of matrices, and each of them have indices. They'll have one index at one endpoint, and they'll have a conjugate index at the other endpoint. And then at the vertices, what we do is we take all those indices and we just find a gauge invariant way of tying them all together to make a number. And those are called intertwining operators. So they're gauge invariant maps between all these incident representations. Pardon?
That's right. Network of, the array of, in addition, don't you have to specify, as you did there in the picture, which links are attached to what vertex?
That's right. So I didn't draw, right, some of these I didn't draw. So I'm going to say when I don't draw one, that means that the representation is the trivial representation. So, hopefully, right. Having a trivial representation is just like measuring nothing along that edge. So it's just equivalent to not having an edge in the graph for the purposes of evaluating this functional.
Do you also draw any intersection?
What do you mean intersections?
Well, you could have more than one line coming out of the vertex.
Like here? You mean?
I don't know. Between any two links, you could have two lines.
Oh, two lines between what? Well, I'm labeling them with a representation. So if there are two fundamentals there, that's going to break up into say it's SU2. If I have two spin on halves, it's going to turn into some sum of zeros and ones, and then I write that as a sum of two different graphs, one with a zero label on here and one with a one label on here. In the case of SU2s, these are just J's along the edges, and on the vertices, these intertwiners are I think someone said they're just related to these Clebsch coordinate coefficients. Yeah. But this is a sort of general construction that you can do. And what's nice about it is that it gives you an orthonormal basis of states that satisfy the Gauss constraint for a non-abelian gauge theory.
This is the natural basis you use in strong coupling? Maybe you said that,
Eric. No, I didn't say that, but that's right. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So obviously orthonormal?
It isn't obvious. Well, it's not obviously orthonormal for some definition of obvious. For different representations, the orthogonality comes from the Peter Weil theorem. And then for the intertwiners, there's just a basis of intertwiners which you have to choose an orthogonal basis to label these things. So the orthogonality of the representations comes for free, and then the intertwiners, you have to sort of work to diagonalize them. Any further questions? OK, great. So that describes an orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space H. And now I'm going to describe a basis of the Hilbert space H sub omega. So I'm going to cut my graph in such a way that I don't touch the vertices. I'm going to cut links sort of through the middle. And now my orthonormal basis basis is labeled by things that look like spin networks in the bulk. So they have representations along all the edges and intertwiners on all the vertices. In addition, for these edges that stick into the boundary, there are going to be I'm going to have representations associated with those. And right at the end point, because I'm relaxing gauge invariance there, I have to include this M label. So in the case of SU2, it's just a, you know, the representation is a J and the M is an M. But in general, it's just it labels a basis of each irreducible representation that enters the edge. And I mean that enters the boundary. And it transforms in the representation, in this representation of the boundary gauge group that's given by the tensor product of all the representations that intersect. So it's been mentioned that the spin network basis solves the Gauss constraint, is orthonormal, it's suitable for strong coupling, but also it tells you exactly how these edge states transform under the gauge group, which will be important for what I'm about to do. Okay. So now I'm going to impose the symmetry. So if my reduced density matrix comes from a gauge invariant state of the full system, I know that it transforms trivially under a product of the gauge group at every boundary point, and I know in which representation it transforms. So I can use group theory to write this thing as a direct sum over all these irreducible representations. There, remember, I had these M labels that live on the boundary that transform in these representations. Because they commute with the representation, they have to be in a maximally mixed state. So they have to be proportional to the identity. And I'm going to normalize that state here. And then for each such choice of representations on the boundary, I could have different possible superpositions of the sort of labels on the inside and those intertwiners. And I'm going to put all of that information into this density matrix rho, which depends on a particular choice of representations that enter the boundary. Good. Okay. So I think I said what rho is, and p is just the probability of having a given choice of representations on the boundary in the initial state that I started with. So the important thing to note about this formula is that different choices of representations on the boundary can't be in superposition. They can be mixed, which is a statement that you are allowed to have fluctuating electric fields. You just can't have a superposition of different electric fields on the boundary. And the way to see that is that this electric field component could be measured on either side of the boundary. So if I have an entangled state and I have some observable that can be measured on the opposite side, if I had a superposition of those states, you could sort of measure it on the other side and collapse it. And I'm not allowed to know whether you did that measurement, roughly speaking. So So that's why you have this superselection rule.
So this is supposed to be the most general density matrix we're allowed to write down on a region.
That's right. So I haven't said anything about it being the ground state of a gap system or anything like that. It's just a gauge invariant. I just demand that it's a gauge invariant state.
Okay.
and that's it.
It comes from a state that's gauging bearing on the whole.
That's right. That's right.
And then you restore.
Well, at this point, it doesn't even need the whole, right? I mean, you could just define this partial system.
Well, if you've done that,
yeah.
You don't necessarily know that the you got the one over dimension that it's max when x is greater.
Yeah.
I don't see where you use the fact that you have another piece of the system at all. You've just got edges there.
If I defined this particular Hilbert space and said that I'm just looking for a density matrix that's invariant under this,
yeah.
Under this group, then I would be led to this without it coming from something else.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
By the way, you've been so rigorous. The system you started out with was defined in a box.
I didn't make any. I don't think I necessarily need it to be
if
finite.
You define it in a box.
Pardon?
Or
what?
Without a boundary. Don't you have to impose some kind of boundary conditions?
You mean like at infinity or something like that?
The same problem of non-local states and the boundaries. So, I mean, for example,
where
are you going to put the edge of the box?
I see. So you're saying if I had a particular, well, I think that there wouldn't be a problem to just impose boundary conditions sort of in the, you know, conducting boundary conditions or something like that at the edge of the box. I don't think that would change anything about the way, if you go into the interior.
Thing as the singlet representation on any links.
Yes. At the last one. Yeah. So
I don't think that this description will be affected by what's happening, by what boundary conditions you impose far away. Okay, good. Oh, yeah, and I pointed out that the M vectors are in a maximally mixed state, which is just like having just the case, for example, if you have a singlet of two spins, then that's always in a maximally mixed state. So the symmetry tells you exactly how mixed it is. Any other questions?
Okay.
Yes?
You assume that the region which you are looking at this, for which you are looking at this subregion A, is it its boundary? Is it contractible, or could it be non-contractible?
I haven't assumed anything about the topology of this region. Yeah.
I see. So then,
it's just a subset. It's just a subset of the nodes of this lattice. Okay, so now, given this sort of decomposition, group theoretic decomposition of the state, I can use the properties of the von Neumann entropy on that state. So, in particular, if I have a tensor product of two density matrices, the von Neumann entropies add. But also, if I have a direct sum of density matrices, it looks like a direct sum of pi, rho I, then that breaks up into the entropy of the distribution piece of I plus the expectation value of the entropies of each individual rho I. Okay. So because the first thing I have is this direct sum over possible representations, the first term that I get is just a classical entropy of that distribution of possible representations entering the boundary. So it's the sort of classical entropy of the electric fluxes through the surface. Okay. Now, the remaining density, so then I have an expectation value of the entropy of that other density matrix, which took the form of a product between a maximally mixed state and another state. So for the maximally mixed state, the entropy is just the log of the dimension.
And so that's this term here.
Okay. So what's interesting about this is because it's a log. So there are a couple of things interesting about it. One is that it's extensive. It takes the form of a sum over all the edges of the boundary. And the other thing is that it appears only for non-abelian groups because the dimensions of the irreducible representations of abelian groups are always one. Okay. And both of these terms are just associated with the boundary. So collectively, I call them S sub boundary. They, you can figure them out just by measuring those correlators directly on the boundary. And then finally, there's a bulk term. So everything else I sort of dumped into this density matrix rho sub r. And in general, there's some entropy associated with that. So right, it sort of had to be this way. In general, you can construct states that have sort of volume scaling entanglement. And so far, I haven't assumed anything about the state. And so there has to be a term like this. But it turns out that in some interesting examples that I'll give, this term is either zero or sort of subleading. So that you can actually focus on the sort of boundary contribution. OK, so just to summarize, this is the part that I'll be using in the examples. There's a term S that I call S sub rep that's associated with the different representations, the sort of fluctuations of the electric field. There's a term that I call S sub dim, which just has to do with the dimensions of those representations. And then there's an S sub bulk, which has to do with the sort of correlations at the interior.
So if you had been considering a scalar field, for example,
yes,
would you have only the last term?
Yeah, that's right. So you can consider the scalar field as like a case where the group is
a bulk term instead of scaling. There'll be some cases where it scales like the volume, but we know that in that case, in many cases, the dominant contribution feels like the area.
Right.
So that would still come from the last term.
That's right. So if this were, yeah, you could consider the sort of trivial case where your state doesn't transform at all under your gauge group. And yes, in that case, you would have just, you know, P of the trivial representation would be one, and then you'd have just that, just one term like that. That's right. So now I'm going to move on to some examples. Okay. So the simplest sort of example where you can see something like this is two-dimensional electromagnetism. So two-dimensional electromagnetism is almost a topological theory, but it's not quite. It's invariant under area-preserving diffeomorphisms. So it can depend on the partition function can depend on the volume of the Euclidean manifold as well as its topology. Okay, good. So if you look at the theory canonically, it lives on a circle. The degrees of freedom are the integral of the connection around the circle, which is defined on this on a compact group. So I'm going to take it to have values between 0 and 2 pi over q. There's a corresponding, its canonical conjugate is the electric field, which is quantized in units of the fundamental charge. And Gauss's law just says that E is constant, and the Hamiltonian is just 1 half E squared integrated around the length of this circle, so 1 half L E squared. And this system is really just quantum mechanics on a circle. Okay. Now, the state whose entanglement entropy I want to look at, so the ground state is sort of too trivial. The ground state is just E equals 0 and has no entanglement. But one can construct a Hartle-Hawking state. Is sort of the first interesting state you can write down. So you can consider this sort of half of Euclidean de Sitter space, which via a path integral gives you a state on the equator, whose wave function is, so this is an unnormalized wave function, it just looks like 1 half times the Euclidean volume times E squared. And so the entanglement entropy in that case is just this representation part. There's no dimension part because it's an abelian group, and there are no bulk degrees of freedom. So it's just sum of the P of E log P of E for this probability distribution. Okay, so far so good. So one can generalize this to two-dimensional Yang-Mills, and the story is almost the same. The only difference is there's now the dimension of the representations can be non-trivial, and there's this dimension term. So it looks like the sort of term associated with the representations minus p log p, and there's a twice the log of the dimension of the representation. Two, because you're considering entanglement between, you know, this half circle with the half circle on the other side, and there are two endpoints to that interval. Okay. And in fact, this answer agrees with the Euclidean replica trick, where the entropy is found by introducing a conical angle in the manifold. You sort of cut a wedge out of here and glue the two pieces together, and consider the following variation, which is just like the usual way you would vary the partition function to get the entropy. Using this known partition function of two-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. And sort of interestingly, this log dim r term, you can see it right in the partition function. It comes from this factor here, dimension of the representation to the chi, where chi is the Euler characteristic of the manifold. So this term, you can see that this dimension term is going to appear in the de Sitter case, where chi is 2, right? That dim r squared turns into this 2 log dim r here. But if you were to calculate, say, just the thermal entropy on a circle, then the Euclidean manifold would be a torus, chi would be 0, and you wouldn't have this term. So it's really just associated with the endpoints of the interval. I should say that this generalizes to fairly straightforwardly to an arbitrary number of intervals. And in that case, this term stays the same, but this one has the number of endpoints, replacing this 2 here. So sometimes when I give this talk, people are surprised at this dimension term appearing, because it's sort of measuring entropy of things that are unobservable degrees of freedom. And so the question comes up, well, couldn't I have just deleted that term and had a reasonable entropy? And so this is my argument for why that really is there. In the context of two-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. So we can consider measuring the electric field at some point. In fact, it's the only thing we can measure locally. Right. So let's say we measure E squared. We're in the Hartle-Hawking state. We expect that the answer we get should be the same as a thermal expectation value in the static patch of de Sitter space. So you could either do that sort of directly in the vacuum, looking at the global state, or you can do it in the static patch. And if you do that, you expect the ratio of probabilities to look like this. It should have an e to the minus beta difference of energies of those two states, where the energy you can read off just from the value of the electric field. But what you find is that it also has this term that depends on the dimension of the two representations. So it's much like having two different macroscopic states. If you look at the sort of the ratio of probabilities between those things, it depends on the sort of number of microstates associated to each one. And the fact that you can't measure those doesn't mean that you don't count their entropy. In fact, that sort of is why you count their entropy. So they're sort of part of the entropy precisely because they aren't observable, in a sense. Okay, so that's it for two-dimensional Yang-Mills. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about the torque code. So the torque code is the simplest example of a system that exhibits topological order. So one description of the torque code is as a Z2 lattice gauge theory. So in the Z2 theory, there are just two representations. There's an alternating and a trivial representation. You think of the alternating representation as representing the presence of an electric string, and the trivial representation as there being no electric string there. And the intertwiners are trivial, except that they enforce that you have to have an even number of electric strings entering any point. Okay. And the Hamiltonian is just a sum of Plaquette operators, or 1 minus Plaquette operators, where the action of these Plaquette operators is just to flip the electric field along each edge of the Plaquette. So if there is an electric string there, you delete it, and if there isn't one, you create it. Okay. And now the ground state of this Hamiltonian, you can sort of make it simultaneously annihilated by all these terms by having an equal superposition of all possible electric strings. So that if you create, if you flip the electric strings on along some set of edges, you just get the exact same state back again. So this this term annihilates that state. And so that so that's the ground state of the toric code. And so I'm now going to say what the entropy of this is. So it turns out that the bulk term vanishes. And the reason for that is that if you fix the representations along the boundary, you just have a state that looks like it's just a pure state on the interior that's just a sum over all possible electric strings with those fixed boundary conditions, but a coherent superposition of them. So there's sort of no correlations between sort of individual bits of electric string at a distance. So we have only this representation contribution, this local contribution. And what we find is that it's almost the area. So each individual representation can either be an electric string or no electric string, except that once you know n minus one of these, you know that the last one, you know that they all have to all add up to zero, because there are no charges. So we subtract one for the number of components of the boundary. And in fact, the fact that this is not precisely extensive actually tells us that we're in a topological phase. This this number, this coefficient here of the non-extensive part, this log 2, is precisely the topological entanglement entropy. So we can find the topological entanglement entropy even from this these considerations that don't know anything. This term that it lives in this term that doesn't know anything about the bulk. It knows just about the boundary correlation. Okay. Any questions on the toric code?
What assumptions are you making about the state here, just that it's a pure state?
Oh, so here I've picked a specific state in the toric code example.
Oh, you've picked the ground state.
Yes, that's right. I know, I'm saying in this state, yes.
All right, in that state.
Okay. Right. Otherwise, it's sort of a, you could have, different states would have different entropy, yeah.
One question.
Yes?
If I put this toric step on the toric, suppose my and my boundaries are non-contractible, answer changes actually. It's not
log 2. Right. So you're saying, okay, so that's right.
Boundary conditions are
okay,
so if
good.
If your total system is a toric.
That's right. So you have four ground states there.
And then you, suppose this is your region, you have non-contractible boundaries now?
Yes, that's right.
Because boundaries are non-contractible, they are these loops.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're more than one ground state, then you can take a linear combination of them.
That's right. And so the ground states in that case are, so I said the ground state is an equal superposition of all string states. So that's true on a genus, on a plane, or on a sphere. So on a torus, what you have is you can have a superposition of all string states that have a fixed electric flux around one cycle, and then fixed one around the other cycle, and that's four.
We can put arbitrary coefficients and take a linear.
Right. So there are four ground states, but of course you can have a superposition as well.
So if your
region is a sphere, you can't tell the difference between those ground states.
Yes,
but then if you make the region go around, you would be able to tell the difference. And I couldn't write down for you exactly what the answer is right now, but I think using this formalism, it's quite straightforward. I think it's still the boundary term. It has to be.
The answer is no.
Yes.
It's actually very similar to what you wrote earlier, so I was thinking it will probably very easily come out of your.
Yeah, I think it would. I haven't worked
like
it out.
PI log PI.
Okay. Great. I'd like to maybe discuss it afterward because if it's a it's probably a straightforward extension of what I've already said, but I haven't done it yet. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Great. So moving on, I'm going to consider the last example, which is which is lattice Yang-Mills at strong coupling. Okay, so there I'm going to consider this Kogut-Suskin Hamiltonian, which consists of two terms. So It's just basically a sum over all the edges of E squared, where E squared is the for a general group represented by the quadratic Casimir of the representation associated with each edge in the spin network basis. And then there's this magnetic field term, which is a sum over all plaquettes of an operator, which is the trace of the holonomy of the gauge field around around that plaquette. So in the strong coupling G large, this term dominates, and this is the one that's diagonal in the spin network basis. Okay, so in that limit, the ground state is just the spin network where all the representations are trivial. And this term we can think of as a perturbation that when it acts on that trivial spin network, it creates a little square where, I denote it here as a little square with a label F, meaning that all the edge fundamental representation of the group. So the ground state in a sort of first order perturbative expansion is the empty spin network plus, there's a square root of P. P is just the probability of having a plaquette at any given point of these single, of these fundamental plaquettes. And the probability goes like the coupling to the minus 8 divided by the square of the quadratic Casimir. It's just basically this term, potential divided by that term, in amplitude, and then you square it to get the probability. Okay, and it's pretty straightforward to apply the formula to that case. You just have to sum. So again, you're dominated by these sort of local terms. You have to sort of add up every possible way that a plaquette can intersect the boundary, which is proportional to the area. So that's picking one intersection point where the plaquette meets. And then there are sort of different orientations around that, which gives this factor of d minus 2. And then the representation, the S sub rep term gives this P log P here. This plus 1 just comes from the normalization of the state. And then there's a logarithmic term, which is just twice the log of the fundamental because each loop intersects twice. So you have explicitly an area law in this strong coupling limit. And the other interesting feature is that it has this non-analytic behavior in coupling because there's a log of G that appears. So it's kind of a G to the minus 8 log G. And the first contributions from the bulk part are actually higher order. They require acting at least four times with this perturbation. So you have to create a loop right on the boundary. You have to create a loop on one side, create a loop on the other side correlated with it, and then you have to delete the loop along the boundary so you don't, otherwise it would be sort of distinguishable in from its boundary representations.
Yes. In this limit, the system is highly gapped.
That's right. So I'd love to be able to tell you the answer for n equals four super Yang mills and the conformal conformal field theory, but yeah, this is not a realistic model of a continuum gauge theory. Its continuum limit is trivial. Yeah. So that's sort of a bug of this way of doing things. I'm going to talk about, with that caveat, I'm going to just talk about what happens at large n. If we write things in terms of this at Hooft coupling, g squared n, and take n to be large, the quadratic Casimir scales like n, and this probability goes, of having a loop goes like lambda to the minus 4 n squared. And so you still have this area law. You can see that the scaling is like n squared, which is what you would expect. In fact, d minus 2 n squared, which is the number of local degrees of freedom. And then it still has this non-analytic nature in the Hooft coupling. So it has the right n squared scaling. Indeed, there's no logarithmic correction like you would get, say, from Ryu Takayanagi. or in a generically in a CFT, and that's because it is, you know, it's this lattice sort of scale confinement, and also it's sort of not the usual large n limit. In order to have these probabilities be small, it's actually a kind of a funny limit where g to the fourth times n is large. So that concludes my talk. So the moral of the story is that in a gauge theory, the entanglement entropy doesn't just follow the usual definition. In order to define it, you need to include these edge states. But this is actually a feature, not a bug, because the edge states transform under the gauge group of the boundary. And exploiting this symmetry, the entropy is really a sum of three terms. There's one, this S sub rep, which is associated with fluctuations of the non-abelian electric field, S sub dim, which is this extensive term for non-abelian theories, and the bulk correlations. But in many cases, the dominant contribution actually comes from the local stuff, which are easily computable. So thank you. And there's more information in these two papers. Thank you.
Counting the entropy thing, which you would have thought was like a gauge of your freedom, is that right? It's like a bit, this mixed thing, this SREP.
This thing, right.
It's pure gauge information, right? It's like you...
I think you maybe mean this one, the dim? Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right.
You sort of make a gauge rotation on in omega, and the same rotation in omega bar, and
that's right.
That counts as a dip, that counts as entanglement.
Yes, it does. It surprised me when I found it, and it surprised many people. But I think I really think that that's there.
But it's this S dim that reproduces the topological entropy.
Oh yes, that's right. So yeah, S rep is that one. Yep. Sorry, I know it's the this is the non-abelian correction. So the.
So in the toric code, that's not there.
In the toric code, this isn't there. Yeah, because it's an abelian gauge theory. But actually, this term never contributes to the topological entanglement entropy, because it's always exactly extensive. So for that reason, you might think it was trivial, but it's state dependent. So if it had just been some universal, area type term that was the same for all states, then you'd be free to absorb it into like a, yeah, right. Or as a gravity person, I'd think of absorbing it into G Newton. But it would just be some non-usual thing, but because it's state dependent, you have to include it.
I have a question.
Yes.
When we have cyber dualities, we do change the gauge group. I would really be interested to know whether the answer changes depending on this choice. It'll be a way to tell the difference. I mean, we know that their infrared is the same, but the UV is in some sense presumably different, and then UV sensitive, right?
So the full entropy I've defined on a lattice, and it is, it has some non-universal UV sensitive parts, but it also has some, some universal parts that you can
other dualities between gauge theories on the lattice, even lattice.
Yeah, that's right. I haven't worked out any example in detail, but what it looks to me is that you completely change the leading area law term, that really is just non-universal, but I think you can the topological terms, for example, will be preserved by that. So in the toric code you can do a trick like this. So I wrote it as a lattice gauge theory in terms of the sort of degrees of freedom living on the boundary. But there's another description, and right, it's 2+1, so it's like a gauge, just like the gauge field is dual to a scalar. You can write this as a theory of the placats. And there it's a little bit trickier to analyze, because the gauge symmetry that you get is a sort of global shift symmetry of the scalar. And it's not actually clear to me how to do an analog of what I did with this with the tensor product breaking up into as this kind of being a direct sum rather than a tensor product. It's not entirely clear to me.
I think people have looked into dualities. So suppose you take this story code, it's dual to globalizing model. Like the Z2 gauge theory is dual to this globalizing model in 2+1D. Mm-hmm. And we know that when I do
what model?
Just the Z2 gauge theory in 2+1D is dual to Ising model, mm-hmm. globalizing model. There's just global symmetry, there's no local symmetry. So, and we know that the topological entanglement entropy for the Ising model is zero, but on the other side, you will say it's non-zero. So what's going on? Well, Ising model is completely trivial. There's no topological order there. Because it's just a direct product state. So there's nothing non-local about it. So what happens is you get, when you do that duality, actually a particular sector gets mapped to linear combination of sectors in the Ising side. So it's not like duality doesn't map a wave function to just one pure wave function. It maps to a linear combination of different sectors.
I mean, if you look at the map on the Hilbert space, it's not just a map.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So because of that, you get minus log 2 plus log 2 from the combination because of the extra
map.
Exactly.
Which is not a unitary.
Exactly. So that gives you the topological
problem. I see. Okay. Great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a question.
Great. Yeah.
If I take a germ science theory, mm-hmm. can you see that you recover the resonant model? Because people have shown it in different ways, that the entanglement Hamiltonian, which is just the recurrency matrix logarithm of that, is just resonant theory, which should be because that's Ives theory.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a different derivation of that statement by people here with Andreas Ludwig.
Okay. I'd like to hear about that. So I think that probably it could be done. I haven't done it. But I think there, what you would do is basically, once you fixed these boundary representations, right? Once you fix this edge state, you have gauge invariance basically tells you exactly how you have to fill in the interior. You sort of don't have a choice there. And so I think that based on that, you could just take the energy and write that as some function of the boundary spins. And I think you'd have a Hamiltonian of some system. And so you could see, you know, if that's sort of a discrete version of the Wessimino thing. Now, I think that's a really good, I think that's a really interesting direction. Yeah.
So another kind of simple example, if you took, say, four-dimensional QED and outside some charge distribution or something, background like that. So how does this all work there in terms of the origin of your different terms? I guess one of them is probably zero, right?
So the dimension one, the one for non-abelian theories would be zero for Maxwell,
other,
for sure.
I guess SREF, is that present?
That would still be there. It's the fluctuations of the electric field through that surface.
Yeah,
the
fluctuations of the electric field through that surface.
Yeah. But not just the sort of integral of the electric field, actually all the, you know, all the electric fields pointing in at all points. Actually Aaron and I have been considering continuum Maxwell theory for a while, and we it's a bit more challenging in the continuum, basically because the you have to be very careful about the way you treat the origin. So if you there's sort of a separate issue in the entanglement entropy. I should back up a bit. The standard method of computing this is via this Euclidean replica trick, where you write down a Euclidean partition function, and you introduce a conical singularity. It turns out that Maxwell fields depending on how you treat the singularity, can actually couple to the curvature and give you a strange answer that's been called the contact term in the previous literature. And so, for example, the results that are known for Maxwell theory include an area, a leading area divergence that's negative. So we've been looking into that issue and how it relates to this picture. We don't have an answer, but I think that it basically involves introducing a sort of brick wall at the horizon and imposing appropriate boundary conditions, basically to shield you from that curvature that you don't want to couple to. And then you get, what you find is that you get a term in the partition function that is suggestive of something like this, but I don't have a definitive answer on whether, on how that appears in the continuum.
There also you can just completely gauge rex, right? And,
yeah, that's right. I mean, you can see, yeah, it's not clear if that's the best way to do it. I mean, that would be one way forward. The way that we've been doing it is through this sort of covariant formalism of introducing Fedeyev Popov ghosts, and because you also gauge fixing is only part of the issue. You also have to be very careful about a few other things, namely, in the two-dimensional case. Right. I was careful to make sure it was a compact gauge group. If it's a non-compact gauge group, you have infinite fluctuations of the zero mode, and those mess with the entanglement entropy. They lead to kind of a spurious divergence there. So you have to go to the U1 theory, and you have to be very careful about the space of flat connections, about including all the bundles, and there's even a term associated with the sort of zero mode of the gauge symmetry. Which was unexpected when we found it, but apparently is known to people that know it. So there's a paper with Aaron from earlier this year where we work out sort of in detail all of those pieces. Usually these things aren't important, but when you're doing something like the entropy, which is depends on the sort of whole partition function, you have to get every piece right, or you can get a very wrong answer. We're confident that we've completely nailed the two-dimensional case, from the Euclidean path integral, and now having done that, we're looking at higher-dimensional cases, we're hoping that'll appear soon.
Thanks.